from the Buzzcocks. Mr. Pete Shelley next on the Culture Catch.
Today's sponsor of our vidcast is Ultrasone, makers of iCans, the best-sounding, safest headphones on the planet. You can visit them at ultrasone.com.
Joining me today, yet again, third time's a charm, Pete, Mr. Pete Shelley from the Buzzcocks. We're having technical problems if you're listening at home, so thankfully, this looks like it's working. Pete, we were talking about the early days of the Buzzcocks earlier.
Yes.
You had answered an ad for someone looking for someone who knew the song Sister Ray by the Velvet Underground.
Yes, to do a version of it.
Not a very well-known song.
No, not really.
How would you even know the song? Did you own the early copy of...
A girlfriend of mine had a friend who had a copy of the Wildlife White Heat album, which Sister Ray is on, and the... third Velvet Underground album, Velvet Underground. And he knew that I was interested in hearing them, so he brought them around one day, and I made a copy of the one cassette. And used
remember
to play
that
the cassettes?
We don't even have cassettes today, do we?
But I know people downloads and rip music. it was similar to that.
For all us old-timers who had vinyl, who still have vinyl, raise your hand. Thank you. You guys have vinyl?
Yes. I mean, the new album, Flat Pack Philosopher, has been released on vinyl.
I love that. I love the fact that that is.
It's four different colors.
Nice.
And my favorite one is the gray one.
Gray. Mm. Ooh. The heavy vinyl, like the...
Yes.
Perfect. Perfect. But I'm sorry. You were getting into the history of the band. So
yes.
Howard had put this ad in.
On the college notice
mm-hmm. board. You answered it. And you started... Now, well, I read initially in your bio that you were doing heavy metal back in that day. True or false? Or
I mean, that was the music of the time, really. But what you would call heavy metal.
Like Slade, although they weren't as heavy as Sabbath, or more Sabbath-y, or...
I suppose anything from Zeppelin to the Groundhogs, you know.
Wow, the Groundhogs. Forgot about them.
Mm.
Yeah. Very good English band. Yeah. So, 75, you have the New York Dolls happening in New York. Was that at all migrating to you guys?
I remember seeing them on the Old Girl Whistle Test, which was the more serious of the contemporary music programs,
right,
at the time. But I mean, before that, there was stuff like Alice Cooper as well,
and Dr. Feelgood.
Well, they were more, but they came more to like the pub rock scene.
Oh, they did. So that would be more like the Graham Parker, the pub rock kind of vibe. Yeah, yeah. Okay. But punk really sprang out of... I mean, there seems to be a lot of discussion as to who actually defined the movement. Was it the Ramones, or was it the Sex Pistols? Or was it Iggy Pop, maybe?
Well, Iggy Pop was the starting model which we used.
Okay.
With the Buzzcocks, because both me and Howard used to like the Raw Power album.
Right.
And so part of the idea when we were doing our songs was keeping that idea in our heads. Until then, we heard the Ramones, and then, of course, that kicked it into a different level again.
Maybe the brevity of the songs with the Ramones, but certainly your songs are a little bit more complex.
I mean, the brevity of the songs came about because we were trying to do what the singles which we'd grown up with.
Right.
So, because in the 60s, there was an awful lot of fantastic singles.
Right.
Which were usually the 3 minutes maximum. And because if you do something in 3 minutes, you've got more time to do something else.
We could fit more on the album?
Yeah. But whereas all the super groups at that time were bringing out albums where sometimes they'd have a track which covered two sides.
Yeah,
you know, there's one track. So, I mean, they were going for more grandiose ideas in music. And it was losing that immediacy, that punch which you needed, you know. But bands like the Ramones, you listen to the first album, and it leaps out, you know, from Blitzkrieg Bop to, you know, Jackie's a Punk. You know.
Right. And they still had kind of that pop thing happening, the Ramones. People forget the Ramones really loved that 60s, just like you're talking about, early 60s pop music. They were such fans, and I think sometimes maybe the volume and just the punky attitude gets lost in the fact they were really good pop songwriters, if you break those songs down.
Yeah, and also there's a lot of humor in it as well.
Yeah, well, you guys certainly had a little bit of that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's part of life, you see. The idea with punk was that it was reflecting life. No, it was about the life which people were living, and not driving along, in a sports car on the freeway. You know,
was it a little bit different coming at it from Manchester as it would have been coming from London? Do you think?
Or yes, very much so, because I mean, there was no real music infrastructure in Manchester or any other the regional cities. Everything was concentrated in London, and everything was concentrated with the major record companies.
Right.
And so if you wanted to get anything done, you needed to go to London to try and get it done. But we booked that trend by actually starting something in Manchester. So when, in about February 1976, me and Howard were reading a copy of the NME, and it said there was this band called Sex Pistols who played a gig at the Marquee Club in London. And it said they did a Stooges song as well. That's what really got our attention first. And then Howard liked the line at the end of the interview. It said, we're not into music, we're into chaos. And I thought, yes, that's fantastic.
That's it.
Because it was an attitude which was born out of ideas.
Right.
I mean, the Sex Pistols were going on about anarchy, and they were wearing shirts with pictures of Bakunin on them. And it was very much so, it was ideas driven. And it wasn't about, things which had no concern to people. But it was about making decisions, and it was about you being responsible for the decisions which you make. So I mean, it was quite liberating stuff, really.
Do you think that the Sex Pistols, you know, we can look back historically and say, you know, they had, you know, their moments of indecency, but it was really to push the buttons of the establishment, much like the music did in the 60s.
Well, it's quite strange now, because if you see what the Sex Pistols were notorious about, it hardly seems to be
It's nothing today,
you
right?
You go, what's the fuss about?
Yeah, exactly.
And you find out that really they were more, eaten up by the monster they created rather than by being monsters creating the chaos.
Now, how many shows did you guys do with them? Did you?
Well, as after we read this review, both me and Howard went down that same night, we're down to London, and I started trying to find Sex Whistles. And we phoned the NME, and they said, they didn't know if they were playing any gigs anywhere, but they were. Their manager had a clothes shop on the King's Road.
Right.
So
called
we went
Sex
to,
or something?
I mean, I remember having a card, and it said, Let It Rock.
Let It Rock.
Because that's what it used to be before that, I think. But it was just before it became Sex.
Right.
And but so we went down the King's Road and found this shop, and they were just about closing up when we went in. And we said, but we're that you manage this band Sex Pistols. Are they playing any gigs? And they were that weekend. It was a Friday but when we arrived. And on the Friday and the Saturday, they were playing two art colleges. So we went to see the band, and we thought they were great. And, of course, they did No Fun, which was, a classic Stooges song.
Right.
And anyway, we got talking to them, and with out of the conversation, they said that they wanted to go and play in other places outside of London. So we said, well, we'll try and arrange something. So we tried to get the people at the college to book them, but they weren't interested.
Right.
And so we hit upon this idea that if we'd hire a hall, because in my previous bands, I mean, that's what I'd do for concerts. Instead of trying to find an agent and play working men's clubs and things like that, where you'd be forced to do covers of everything.
Right.
But the only
You're
way
brave to admit that, Pete. You're a very brave man to admit that.
No, but I never
do.
Did that because I wasn't really interested in that kind of music. And in fact, when me and Howard started Buzzcocks, one of our mission statements was that we won't but play the normal pub rock circuit and play cover songs because then there'd be no us doing what we wanted to do, which was playing our own songs.
Right out of the gate. And
we knew that if we went to these places and tried to play our own songs, because punk was almost the most uncommercial form of music. I mean, there was no idea in our minds that anything would come of it, except us enjoying doing it.
Sure.
And so in a way, it was really trying to wind people up. You know, we expected people not to like it.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I guess in my mind, I never made the connection, the Iggy connection with your band, but it really, now that you're explaining to me, makes perfect sense for how you guys consolidated that sound.
Yeah,
and that attack,
it was
more the attack or something.
Yeah, it was trying to get something which was, well, I mean, but at that time, very marginalized, very left field, because it was almost, it was like using music as a weapon.
Mm.
I mean, rather than it's being used to entertain.
Yeah, I want to be your dog. I mean, you know, that song says it all, right? And then I guess you can make the migration to Orgasm Addict.
Yeah.
It's not a tough leap of faith. How did that song happen? Was that one of those things that just fell in?
Or? Well, I mean, along with the... it all came about by reading William Burroughs. Because in many of the books, he talks about orgasm addicts.
Right.
And I had this idea of orgasm addicts. And you always used to find when you used to go to a club, at the end of the night, about half an hour before the club was to shut, you get people desperately trying to hook it up.
Yeah.
And so it was this idea about, you know, like being obsessed by sex. And so I wrote the first bell lines, you tried it just for once, found it all right for kicks. So you found it, it's having that stitch, you all get some addict. And then I gave that to Howard just to show him how it went. And he completed the rest of it.
That's great. Did you ever think that song would become so much of a ingrained into the youth consciousness at the time?
Well, it is. It's everywhere we go. That's definitely a crowd pleaser.
Yeah. And it just, I guess it represents, for some just breaking out of the repression that maybe is youth or the parental repression of sexuality or,
yeah.
you know, all of the taboos.
It's become more of a song of celebration.
Right.
I mean, it started off as a sort of social commentary on
right.
the people obsessed by sex.
Do you ever get tired performing it? You know how some artists say, like, oh, God, I loathe playing this song.
Well, the good thing is we have so many songs, and the songs which we leave out of the set, I mean...
You can leave it out one night and play it the next?
It's always a joy to play.
Ah.
I mean, like, we don't really tire, but if there was a song which we get fed up with playing...
If it was 16 minutes long, would it be a different experience?
It would, and it probably wouldn't have happened.
A Sister Ray version of Orgasmatic. I was reading... on the website yesterday, one of the music sites, and they said that if you looked at the Sex Pistols album and London's Calling, you'd have to put Singles Going Steady right up there in the pantheon of punk rock. That, you know, toe-to-toe, pound-for-pound, it's every bit as dynamic as those two records. And I thought, that is quite a compliment to pay somebody. But you guys were really writing singles. You weren't thinking about albums back then, were you?
Well, the first in 1978, we actually released two albums.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, as well as loads of singles, which went on to.
So the albums were already released, and the singles, you just kept writing music. You're prolific writers.
Well, it wasn't so much that they were all written from scratch. Songs like "Love You More" I wrote in 1975, so
right.
that's really sort of a year before, the first punk happened.
Because you had a solo record before that, correct? Or the makings of a solo record?
There was an electronic album called Skyen.
Right.
Which came out in the late 70s, but it was actually recorded in about 74.
Right, okay. That must kind of predate then the Pete Shelley solo experience, the Homo Sapien.
It's around that, but it's sort of around that time because the song Homo Sapien I wrote in 1974 as well.
Gotcha. So you had two records out. Now, IRS was the label in the States.
Yes.
And you guys, right out of the gate, had recognition. Thanks to NME. I mean, NME has really championed the indie band spirit. They can really have them. But it's not always easy to migrate from the UK to stateside. What was the moment of arrival for you, in your mind, stateside?
Well, I mean, the album Singles Going Steady was actually released as a in the States first.
Before the other two?
Yeah.
Right.
But the other two had been out in Britain, and in Britain people had actually heard the singles as they were being released. And so by then I think we'd released eight singles. So the idea was to put the eight singles with the B-sides onto one album and to release that as being the sort of a taste of what Buzzcocks is.
You know, I got it. Now, kind of like what they did with the Beatles.
Yeah, yeah.
Because the album propers were different than the kind of comps that they put together on the state side for the Beatles. So they introduced, and Miles introduces the band, and you guys right out of the gate have traction. Was that pretty dynamic for you? I mean, a country as big as America, did you expect that?
Well, we'd already had a lot of success in Britain at that time. But America was still, it was a different America to what it is now.
Right, yeah, sure.
Because I think it was only after the bands from Britain actually went to sell, punk to the Americans. Some people argue it came from New York and things like that, but that's just a ripped T-shirt having a safety pin in it. I mean, all the real work was done in Britain, really. But we came over, I mean, there's places like New York, Chicago, LA, there was a lot of interest in the band because people had heard what we were, capable of. And some people were buying the records and imports and everything. So there was like a really big dedicated following, which we already had.
That was part of the punk ethos, too. I think, I grew up in Ohio, and if you were into this kind of music, if one of the bands were coming through Cleveland, you were there.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
You had that probably all across America, these pockets of devoted fans who said, wow, this is the music for me. So I guess now in today's internet days, it's much easier to spread that word through MySpace and other means.
It is, yeah. I mean, that's a real difference. I mean, in the UK, there was a DJ, John Peel.
Right,
who
John
had a late
Peel,
night
of course.
Show. And he listened to punk, and he loved it, and started playing punk. He lost loads of listeners because they're right. like he used to play Tangerine Dream, and then all of a sudden he was playing Spiral Scratch. Or,
right, sure.
You know, having Buzzcocks and doing sessions.
Right.
And so it was really the Jungle Telegraph of what I think, because I mean the papers like NME, they were, I mean, they'd write about music, but you still had no idea what it sounded like.
Sure. And the BBC wasn't going to play it.
And the BBC weren't going to play it, especially not during daytime.
Right.
But he had the John Peel had this late night show, so he would play things, and people would send in the recordings and cassettes and things of songs which he'd done. And if he liked them, he would play them on the radio.
You know, we really miss those days. I have to tell you, you know, with all of this internet and the satellite and everything, we miss the power of one voice.
Mm-hmm.
In the old days, I mean, we had like the Wolfman Jacks in America, and you know, the old transistor radios, and you'd pick them up 60,000 watts. But we miss, it's so hard, it's so factioned today that, you know, I wonder if you didn't have a name, how tough it would be to have your music, if it was just being released today, heard, you'd have to build your groundswell through the internet.
Well,
and tour.
But it's the actual doing of it which gets you the recognition.
Right. Did you guys always enjoy playing out live, or were you more comfortable in the studio?
The two different experiences, really. But being in the studio is good because it's like a discovery. Because it's just an idea that you've got in your head, and you can play the song, but really you're learning things about the song as you're spending the time doing
right.
it. I mean, sometimes you know you've come up with a guitar solo just for the or crystallize something which, I mean if it's the lyrics, I mean sometimes the lyrics used to change, and you know there used to be different versions of. Things depending on what I could remember at the time when I was singing it. But when you go in the studio, then you do the definitive version of it.
So you like the chance discovery that the studio experience offers, as opposed to being too prepared, where maybe you may miss some kind of... You hear the bass playing something, and that inspires something else on
the
guitar.
Yeah, it's all about... Because there's excitement in discovery.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're doing things which... I mean... Yourself have never heard before,
right?
And things can come out, and you know, and you get a good rush when it's all going really well. But playing live is all a different thing because that's you actually doing the songs. I mean, I would say that people tend to forget that music isn't just for listening to. But the actual making of it, actual singing a song, is different to listening to a song.
And that communal exchange that you have with the crowd when they're really enthusiastic, do you find it's diminished over the years? I mean,
no,
an adult now. When you started out, you were a young man.
I mean, it's got more. Well, I mean, I wasn't even that young when I started out.
Well, you look great for your age.
Thank you.
So I wouldn't even. I'm guessing, you know, you're probably in your early 50s.
Yeah, okay. 51.
But I mean. You know, it's funny, we've grown up with rock and roll. It's no longer taboo to say, you know, hope I die before I grow old.
Yeah.
You can, if you have the artistry of your music, you can continue to do it. Jazz musicians do it.
Yeah, yeah.
Bluegrass musicians do it, you know. Why not? So, do you ever feel like some nights, like, God, you know, I don't know if I can, you know, muster up that energy for this music?
No, it's usually in the mornings.
So you really have the workmanlike attitude, like, I enjoy the music, this is my gig,
well,
and I'm here to deliver.
I mean, in order to do it, you've got to have a certain, you know, that in all weathers, you know, you know, through rain or snow. Or,
sure, yeah. You have good days and you have bad days.
Yeah, you've got to, I mean, part of the idea of touring is that you say, right, we're doing these dates. I mean, but some people have commented when they see on the internet, our touring schedule, And they say, wow, that's a load of dates. I say, well, yeah, but it's only one day at a time. So
yeah.
Each one. And as you go down, I mean, I think the last gig we got planned at the moment is in September. And it's in Tokyo. And Tony, our bass player, was... I think he said yesterday that was the 111th gig that we'll have done this year.
Wow.
Started in March, so this is by September. So in 6 months, we've done about 111
gigs.
That's
robust. Yeah. So what are your trade secrets on the road? How do you just catch sleep when you can? And
yeah. Well, I mean, I can almost sleep standing up. So.
Okay.
I enjoy it on the tour bus as well, because I'm small enough so I can fit into a bunk.
And how about this exchange where you have to, you know, interview journalists and, you know, sometimes you're being asked the same question over and over. How do you weather that? That can be very frustrating.
Sometimes it is. But on the other hand, in everyday, living, you don't really think about some of the things which a question can set your train of thought thinking about. So you can actually learn something about what you actually think or feel by being asked the right questions.
Okay. So put it to task, all you journalists listening. Ask the right questions. I know that's always the tough thing, because you've covered a lot of ground in your career. You have a catalog, and you have a perspective.
Yeah.
And as a seasoned veteran, that's a good thing, because you can, you know, offer some words of wisdom.
Yes, because I was also saying to Steve last night, I said, doing something for 30 years... If you haven't found out how to do it right, you know, if you haven't improved, then you're doing the wrong thing.
Right. Now, I forgot to ask you, when Howard left the band, was it a shock to you? Did you feel like you were missing a part of the band?
Well, yeah, it was, really. I mean, I was liking it to, like, somebody being called in for the dinner, you know. The thing when your kid's playing, you know, out on long summer evenings, and then somebody gets... the call that they have to go home and have the dinner, then you think, oh, you know, and
that's a sweet metaphor.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, then he started his other band, and was it awkward for you guys for a while?
No.
It was all amicable and...
Yeah. In fact, I co-wrote the first single that magazine put out, Shot by Both Sides. Because I was playing the riff one day, and I said, what's that? And I said, oh, it's a song I've not really finished it or got, you know, anywhere with it. And he said, oh, can I borrow it? Because he had some words and he thought would fit with it.
Right.
Which was Shot by Both Sides. And I said,
yeah. I had no idea. That's
I said,
a
you
good
can
story.
Use that for your, you know, but for your new band.
Did you get credit on that?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, good. That's a very good song. Well, you really have a knack for writing those hooks. And I guess it must go back to your love for the 60s when you... those hooks from the Kinks and all these great British explosion music.
Yeah, the thing with melody as well as rhyme is that it's an aid to remembering something. If you remember something as a rhyme, then even if you forget what the end bit is, you've got a good idea about where it's going to be.
That's a good tip for songwriters.
And the thing with melody is a similar thing, because with melody, once you've got the start of it, then the rest of it is usually, you know, there's like little tricks which are employed musically. But the melody is a way of remembering the, you know,
right.
A song.
But you've used, we were talking earlier about when you went solo.
Yeah.
Was it 80, 81?
81.
81, and Homo Sapien came out, the album and the record, and that became like a huge club anthem.
Mm.
And you certainly married the synth-pop thing to your guitar thing.
Well, that started out, we were doing actual... But that album started off as being the demos for the fourth Buzzcocks album.
Really?
Yeah. But after... I think we spent about 7 or 8 hours just by doing the one for Homo Sapien. And at the end of it, Martin Rushen, who was also the Buzzcocks producer.
Oh, what a great producer.
He turned around and he said, it's not a demo anymore, this. This is a record.
It's ready to go.
It's ready to go. You know, it doesn't need,
the rest of the mates.
To go back to the band and say, you know, to make this, you know.
So it was by accident, really?
Yeah. And it was such a fun way of doing it because neither me nor Martin were keyboard players. You know, we're not, you know, there was no way of actually making synths do anything unless you were playing keyboards. But Roland brought out this an MC8.
Yeah.
It was like a sequencer, it was really like a cash register.
Right.
Had a number keyboard, and the thing, you could choose the note, you could choose how long that note lasted for, and when the next note was going to play. And you'd feed in these numbers, and that would give you, and then plug it into the synthesizer, and you could have it playing the thing while you fiddled about, adjusted the sound. And you could also sync it up, so you could do multi-track recordings of it. So that was really the start of.
And it gave it really that sound that the Homo Sapien record, that vibe that.
It was. I'd say it was a really easy way of actually making music. It was a bit long-winded because you had to write down what you wanted it to play,
right, right,
and then program that in, but. It was a lot easier than having to learn to play keyboards.
Right, sure. Have you ever gone back and tried it in any of your update? You know, any of the new songs?
No, not really. Because yeah. I mean, since the, I mean, nowadays it's very rare to actually find a synthesizer like synthesizers used to be.
Right. But a lot of the young kids now, I know. Sometimes you go see them play, and they've got these banks of vintage keyboards out, and they're, you know. They're taking the. I saw an old Moog that looked like the original Dark Side of the Moon Moog from, you know, live at Pompeii on a stage one day, and I'm like, oh my god, this should be interesting. But I guess now with everything so microed out, you can get everything on one little keyboard, can't you?
Well, you can do it on a laptop.
Yeah, well, that's true. Yeah, you can trigger everything on a laptop. Pro Tools. But you do.
I mean, soon you'll be able to do it all on a mobile phone.
You probably can in Japan already, right? I wanted to ask you. You guys really maintain still that organic sound. Do you really work hard at almost a live vibe when you're laying down tracks? Are you guys all in the same room?
No, not really.
No, you're not all baffled, because it really sounds like it's almost.
It was all done.
Really? Please don't tell me you're using click track. Are you using click track?
I think there probably was a click track.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, it surprises me because it has a real organic vibe, almost like. There was no click track on some of the tracks. Good for you guys for being able to fake it.
Yeah, yeah.
That's one of the things that bothers me about Pro Tools. When you slave with the click track, it just sounds so like, okay, when are you going to just miss a bit? Just, you know, get ahead of the beat or behind the beat a little bit. Give it some...
Well, there was lots of, and there was also lots of editing on the drums and and things like that. I mean, it was really taken apart and then reassembled.
Okay. You know, I wanted to ask you, are there any bands from your heyday that you really feel stand the test of time besides the Sex Pistols and the Clash? Are there any bands that maybe we've forgotten about that have slipped through the cracks?
Well, one which slipped through the cracks, I believe, is Jonathan Richman.
Ah.
So, like...
Roadrunner.
Yeah.
Jerry Harrison of the Talking Heads.
Yeah. If you listen to... what's it called? So the Modern Lovers album,
right?
It's very punky,
and that predated you guys by what? That came out in 72 or 73,
yeah,
didn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah.
I don't think it really even got released until maybe punk started to hit, because it was like out and kind of disappeared, and then an American indie label, Berserkly or one of those,
Berserkly
re-released it in 77 or something, as I recall.
Yeah,
and then it became that Roadrunner song became. An anthem well after the fact, and he'd already reestablished himself as kind of this neo-folky then.
Yeah, he was doing Ice Cream Man. And
right. I'm a local mosquito.
Yeah.
Or was that Iggy? Did Iggy do a mosquito song too?
No, but I know Jonathan Richman did a mosquito song.
So, yeah, okay.
And things like Bank Teller.
Bank Teller, yeah. Yeah, I forgot about that. Oh, very, very good. Who are your favorite bands? Just in general.
In general, I like the Residents.
They have a new project out right now.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. It's a whole multimedia experience. I'm dying to interview one of them. I wonder if they take their mask off. It's probably like Steve Jobs or somebody's one of the residents.
I did go actually backstage at the residence.
You did? Did you see him with the masks off?
I wouldn't know because they didn't do the.
You've been sworn to secrecy.
Because
they held a knife to your throat.
Because they weren't. You see, I didn't see. I mean, there wasn't some dude there in a mask who then took it off. It was just a room full of people.
So you can't be
so
sure.
I don't know.
It was a sweaty bloke there. Four sweaty blokes. Is it Buckethead? Who is it? Oh, my God. What a great story that is. The Residents. There's another band that probably never got their due commercially. But talk about prolific. They're always pushing the envelope and doing really interesting things. So who else how about just in the arts? We established you like Burroughs. Are there any other literary heroes of yours?
There's the Argentinian writer Borges.
Okay, sure.
But somebody once sent me a photocopy of one of the short stories.
Wow.
It just arrived in an envelope through the mail. But with no explanation, really.
And hopefully and so it was transcribed to English, though.
Yeah. If it's in English version. Yeah. And I opened it up and it was this photo and I thought, who sent me this? You know? So there's one day I was in bed and I got the envelope and started reading it. And I was hooked ever since then.
Fantastic. How about theater, cinema? Do you have any literary heroes in those arts? I guess what I'm trying to establish is...
I suppose things like David Lynch... And
have you seen his website? He's got a wonderful website, and he's offering ringtones now. And I read this yesterday. I can't wait. I've been to his website, and he has an animation series on his website. It's like $9.99 to join his site. It's really twisted, but the ringtones are something like, I want to hit you with my tennis racket until you're bloody, like really out, ringtones, as only Lynch could. But it's funny you should mention Lynch. Has he ever approached you? Because he's a big music fan.
No, but any.
Huh. I wonder if he's ever seen you live. Maybe Pam could hook that up for you, get David to your shows in L.A.
And then other ones are like, Terry Gilliam.
Sure. Time Bandits. Love Time Bandits.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
And the Don Quixote movie. Did you see the documentary on that?
Yes, I saw it. But
it was just the most... The nearly making of Don Quixote with Johnny Depp. What a sad story, because you could imagine how brilliant that would have been if they completed it. Mm. And the actor they hired to play Don Quixote was amazing, wasn't he? But he hurt his back and he couldn't ride the horse and that whole thing. Very fascinating story. Anyway, so when you're not making music, what are you doing? What are you most passionate about?
I don't know, really.
What do you like to feel? Are you somebody that likes to tinker and noodle with things and just fill your time in all areas of the arts?
Well, I suppose the thing which takes up a lot of time is the internet, really.
Do you have a MySpace page?
Yes.
And it is the Buzzcocks, or is it...
Well, there's the... Buzzcocks Official is the...
A Buzzcocks Official.
Yeah. And then I have two Pete Shelley. I have Pete Shelley Solo and Pete Shelley.
Pete Shelley Solo and Pete Shelley.
Yeah.
Why do you have Pete Shelley Solo and Pete Shelley?
Because when the Homo Sapien album came out, I set up a music one.
Gotcha.
For Pete Shelley Solo.
Nice. And do you answer all of your...
Well, I read everything.
Right.
I don't necessarily get into answering. I mean, the problem is that I tend to read things. Like, I'll get up in the morning and I'll have a cup of tea and I'll check my emails and messages and things. And so I'll get to read them and then sometimes I think, I'll answer. But, it's like things like getting dressed get in the way and then you go off on another tack then.
Sure.
So, I mean, I'm not really one for, answering a lot of stuff, but I do read it, and if there's anything which I understand it and can be given a quick answer, then I'll probably
something strikes you as being pertinent or intelligent or strikes a chord with you. How about football? Do you follow football?
No, never been to a football match. On Saturdays, when everybody else would go to football, I would hang around by record shops and
collecting that vintage vinyl.
And guitar stores.
Ah.
Well, no, it wasn't really like that much, actually buying it, really. We used to spend a lot of time just looking, you know, just flicking through the racks. And
yeah, I can spend that hours myself. Us,
yeah. Because, I mean, it was less of a supermarket experience in those days.
Right, exactly.
I mean, but now when you go to a record store, there's rows and rows, you know, there's far too many.
Right.
And they've got the label, you know, the sections all marked.
It's easy to find.
It's easy to find things, yeah.
Are there any contemporary acts that have really that are happening that you feel like they've done us good? You know, they borrowed the Buzzcocks song. I can think of a couple. I mean, I'm wondering what you.
Well, I mean,
flattery is the sincerest form.
Yeah. Imitation.
Imitation is the sincerest form of flattery. Is that how it goes? Yeah. Thank you, Pete.
I mean. A lot of what we do has been borrowed, shall we say. In fact, the other week we got presented with an honour from the magazine Mojo.
Ah,
and it was
congratulations.
An inspiration. And it was actually voted for by the public as well.
Fantastic.
So the other people in the list, because we didn't expect to win it, really. We just thought we'd be nominated. It was a nice gesture. And they said there was Sparks, Johnny Cash, The Fall, and Paul Weller.
Wow.
And Buzzcocks.
That's a pretty impressive lineup to share.
And so then people, you know, it was one of the categories which was open to public vote. And when we won it.
Congratulations. Thank you. So the young bands, who do you think have a fair shot at really borrowing your sound? Are you a fan of the young bands like the Futureheads and the Killers and Franz Ferdinand?
Well, Franz Ferdinand, I mean, I like the first album and parts of the second. The second album's always a bit difficult.
Yeah, it is, right? 26 years to make your first record and 6 months to make your second.
Yeah,
good
yeah.
luck. Better save some material, right? Is there anyone that you've heard, though, you really thought has longevity? I think that's the big question with bands today, isn't it? Like, outside of Radiohead, who do we think has any longevity? It could last 30 years like the Buzzcocks. Green Day? Does Green Day have legs?
Well, I mean, Green Day have now been going for...
They've been added for about 15, time, right?
Yeah.
So they're halfway there, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
But anyone else in your mind, do you think, or do you not really give it that much thought?
I don't really give it that much thought, man.
Okay, fair enough. We'll edit that bit out.
I mean, like, music is something which, I don't know, I mean, I don't really see it as a sort of an end in itself, really.
Right.
I don't really consider myself to be a musician.
Really?
Yeah.
Why is that?
Because I don't. In my mind, it's. It's a means to an end.
Huh.
I mean, the song is the bit which I like, which I gain most pleasure out of, but rather than just the playing of it. But, I mean, it took us about 2 or 3 weeks rehearsing just to do the songs off the new album, which we got to learn how to play them, because, like I say, it was all done. Bits and pieces
right.
over a long period of time, so that was the first time we'd actually all been in a room, and with the idea at the end of 3 minutes we'll have played that song,
beginning, middle, and end. Let's get on with it.
So it was time to learn the parts and then make sure that everybody knows what their part is and what we should be doing and what that chord is there and everything
right.
like that. So it was a lot of hard work, and at some points it was just like giving up, you know.
Whereas maybe like a classically trained musician would say, well, I've got the notations here and I can play, but then there's no spirit in that. There's no passion, is there? I mean, there can be, but it's a little difficult. You guys have a little bit more room for collision of sound and that energy.
Yeah, but I mean, it's something, if you try too hard to make it, then you know, so you really got to trust that. That you're capable of doing it, and then just go ahead and keep doing, you know, trying to do it until you get it right.
So if I'm sitting next to you in an airplane, you're not going to introduce yourself as Pete Shelley, the musician?
No, no.
You'll just say the gentleman farmer? If you didn't do music, what do you think you would have done?
I don't know. I mean, in some ways, I always thought it was like, if I think about myself when I was younger, it's almost like I was always going to do this. And that I probably did something with computers, be a computer program, right, or something like that. Because I was interested in computers, you know, from when I was at school.
You know. Right.
But then the best you could do is to store your program, where you type out your program.
I was going to say keystroke the ticker tape.
On ticker tape, and then send that off.
Yeah.
To be processed on a big computer, then come back with the sheets.
That great scene in Willy Wonka, in the original Willy Wonka, when they have the ticker tape. Who has the golden ticket? That would have been you keystroking that in.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I guess finally, what would you like your legacy to be?
Well, I think in some ways our legacy is already here. The main thing which punk did was it brought back that sense of urgency into music. I think one of the reasons why we're still seen as being, and the reason why the new album is seen as being a contemporary album, even though people can say quite rightly it sounds like we'd done it back in the late 70s, is because now, because of the people borrowing parts of our music over the years, it's become part of the
fabric.
What is going on. And I mean, in the same way like Chuck Berry.
Mm.
You know, I mean, he's been ripped off by everyone from the Beach Boys.
Sure.
But really, if Chuck Berry plays, he doesn't sound out of place. Whereas when he started out, he was really way out there with what he was attempting to do.
Right.
But no, it just seems like part of just the fabric, as you say.
Right.
And it's the same with Buzzcocks, really, in that people can hear us now. And we're getting a lot of the younger kids come into the shows now, and it's people who I was at the T-shirt stall yesterday, and there were blokes coming in with their daughters and sons, and so you know there's
the generations,
the generations,
two generations.
Yeah, so it's going to be like the Grateful Dead.
Oh, no, come on, a little different. You're being kind. Well, continued success, and we look forward to seeing you back and enjoy the rest of the tour. And where do I get one of those great Buzzcocks jackets?
Well, they added the exact one on the T-shirt store.
Oh, okay. Good deal. All right. Thanks, Pete.
Thank you.
Cheers. Today's podcast was sponsored by Ultrasone, makers of iCans, the safest headphones on the planet. Visit them today at ultrasone.com. This is Dusty Wright for the Culture Catch. We'll see you soon. Converge is the word.